They embraced and swapped insults, and found an empty bench near the point where the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers merge. A large fountain spewed water behind them.
"You're not eating," Joey said.
"Not hungry. Go ahead." Joey set aside his deli sandwich and studied the combat boots. "You seen Kyle?" Baxter asked. And they spent a few minutes catching up about Kyle, Alan Strock, and a few of the other fraternity brothers. When Baxter spoke, he did so softly and slowly, and he gazed across the rivers, as if his tongue were working but his mind were engaged elsewhere. When Joey spoke, Baxter listened but did not really hear.
"You seem detached," Joey said, blunt as ever.
"It's just weird being back, you know? Plus, it's so different now that I'm sober. I'm an alcoholic, Joey, a full-blown raging alcoholic. And now that I've stopped drinking and all that poison is out of my system, I look at things differently. I'm never going to drink again, Joey."
"If you say so."
"I'm no longer the Baxter Tate you once knew."
"Good for you, but the old Baxter wasn't such a bad guy."
"The old Baxter was a selfish, pompous, egotistical, drunken pig, and you know it."
"True."
"He would have been dead in 5 years." An old barge inched along the river, and they watched it for a few minutes. Joey slowly unwrapped his turkey on rye and began eating. "I'm working my way through recovery," Baxter announced quietly. "Are you familiar with the process in Alcoholics Anonymous?"
"Sort of. I had an uncle who sobered up a few years ago and is still active in AA. It's a great program."
"My counselor and pastor is an ex-con, known affectionately as Brother Manny. He found me in a bar in a Reno casino 6 hours after I left the rehab clinic."
"Now that's the old Baxter."
"Indeed. He's led me through the 12 steps recovery process. Under his direction, I've made a list of all the people I harmed along the way."
"Talk about frightening.
I had to sit at a table and think of all the people I've hurt because I was drunk."
"And I'm on the list?"
"No, you didn't make it. Sorry."
"Darn."
"It's mainly family members. They're on my list, and I'd probably be on their lists if they ever got serious about life. Now that I've made the list, the next step is to make amends. That's even more frightening. Brother Manny beat his first wife before he went to prison. She divorced him, and years later, when he sobered up, he tracked her down to say he was sorry. She had a scar above her lip, thanks to him. And when she finally agreed to meet with him, he begged for forgiveness. She kept pointing to the scar. She was crying, he was crying. Sounds horrible, doesn't it?"
"It does."
"I assaulted a girl one time. She's on my list."
The turkey on rye froze halfway down the esophagus. Joey kept chewing, but the food wasn't moving.
"You don't say."
"Elaine Keenan. Remember her? She claimed we raped her at a party in our apartment."
"How could I forget?"
"Do you ever think about her, Joey? She went to the police, scared the hell out of us. We almost hired lawyers. I tried my best to forget about it, and I almost did. But now that I'm sober and my mind is clear, I'm remembering things better. We took advantage of that girl, Joey."
Joey placed the sandwich aside.
"Maybe your memory is not as sharp as you think. What I remember is a wild girl who loved to party, loved to drink and snort coke, but what she loved the most was random sex. We did not take advantage of anyone. At least I did not. If you want to revise history, then go ahead, but don't include me."
"She passed out. I went first, and while I was doing it, I realized she'd blacked out. Then I remember you walked up to the sofa and you said something like, 'Is she awake?' Do you remember any of this, Joey?"
"No."
Portions of it were familiar, but Joey wasn't sure anymore. He'd worked so hard to forget the episode, then he'd been shocked back to reality when Kyle described the video.
"She claimed she was raped. Maybe she was right."
"No way, Baxter. Allow me to refresh your memory. You and I had sex with her the night before. Evidently, she liked it, because on the night in question, we bumped into her again and she said, 'Let's go.' She consented before we got back to our apartment."
Another long pause as each tried to anticipate what was next.
"You thinking about having a little chat with Elaine?" Joey asked.
Maybe. I need to do something, Joey.
I don't feel right about what happened.
Come on, Baxter. We were all drunk out of our minds. The whole night was a blur.
Oh, the wonders of alcohol. We do things we don't remember. We hurt others because of our selfishness. And when we finally sober up, we are compelled to at least apologize.
Apologize? Let me tell you a quick story, Brother Baxter. I bumped into Elaine a few weeks ago. She lives in Scranton. I was passing through on business, saw her in a deli during lunch. I tried to be civil. She freaked out on me, called me a rapist. I suggested we get together a few hours later for a polite cup of coffee. She showed up with her lawyer, a real tough broad who thinks all men are scum. So let's say you go over to Scranton, find her, and tell her you're sorry because there's a good chance she was telling the truth after all, and you want to feel better about yourself because now you're sober and you have this desire to be a good little alcoholic. Know what'll happen, Baxter? Indictments, arrests, trials, lawsuits, prison, all of the above. And not just for you, Brother Baxter, but for some of your friends as well.
A brief gap as Joey caught his breath. He had Baxter on the ropes. Time to finish him off.
Her lawyer explained that the statute of limitations on rape is 12 years in Pennsylvania, so time has not expired. We got a long way to go. You get near her with some half-baked, feel-good apology, and you'll find out what rape is all about when they lock you away.
Joey jumped to his feet, walked across the boardwalk, and spat at the rivers. He returned to the bench, but didn't sit down. Baxter hadn't moved, but he was shaking his head.
She wanted the sex, Baxter, and we were happy to accommodate her. You're blowing this way out of proportion.
I've got to talk to her.
Hell no! You're not going near her until the four of us, me, you, Kyle, and Alan, have a long discussion. That'll be ugly, won't it?
I need to talk to Kyle. He has more sense than the rest of us.
Yes, he does, but he has a crushing workload, tremendous stress.
Joey tried to imagine such a meeting between the two. Kyle, thinking about the video, while Baxter and his amazing new memory confirmed the details. It would be a disaster.
I'll go to New York, Baxter said.
Don't do it.
Why not? I'd like to see Kyle.
Okay, but if you talk to Kyle, then talk to Alan, too. Everybody talks for a good long time before you go blundering into Scranton and screw up our lives. I'm telling you, Baxter, this girl is out for blood, and her lawyer has a nose for it.
Another long gap in the conversation. Joey finally sat down and thumped his pal on the knee. Just a couple of old frat brothers who still cared for each other.
You can't do this, Baxter,
Joey said with as much conviction as he could muster. At the moment, he was thinking about his own skin. How would he tell Blair, who was now 5 months pregnant?
Hey, babes, just got a phone call. Seems they want me downtown. Something about a rape charge. Could be serious. Might not be home for dinner. Someone said reporters are waiting. Catch it on Channel 4. Later. Hugs and kisses.
I'm not sure about what happened, Joey,
Baxter said, softly and slowly as ever.
But I know what I did was wrong.
My uncle, the alcoholic. When he went through AA, he made a list too. He had stolen a rifle from my father, and he saved his money until he could buy another one. Brought it to the house one night. Big surprise, big scene. But if I remember correctly, you, as the alcoholic working your way through the 12 steps process, cannot make amends if doing so will harm others. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Then there's your answer. If you approach her and beg forgiveness, she and her lawyer will go nuts and drag in me and probably Kyle and Alan as well. You can't do it, because it will harm us.
If you did nothing wrong, you have nothing to worry about. I'm confronting what I did, and what I did was wrong.
This is crazy, Baxter. Look, you're clean and sober and full of the gospel. Good for you. I'm very proud of you. The future looks great, yet you're willing to throw it all away and risk 20 years in prison? Come on! This is madness!
Then what should I do?
Get your ass back to Reno or somewhere far away and forget about this. Go live a great life out there. Just leave us alone.
Two policemen walked by, laughing, and Joey stared at the handcuffs on their belts.
You can't do this, Baxter, he said. Give it some time. Pray about it. Talk to your minister.
I have already.
And what did he say?
He said to be cautious.
Smart guy. Look, you're in a state of transition right now. Everything is unsettled. You're out of LA, you're clean and sober, all good stuff. Again, I'm proud of you. But it's a mistake to rush off and do something foolish.
Let's walk, Baxter said, and slowly rose to his feet. They strolled along the river, saying little, watching the boats. I really want to see Kyle, Baxter finally said.
Chapter 27. In the 4.5 months Kyle had lived in his grim little apartment, he had managed to avoid having guests. Dale had asked about it a few times, then let the matter drop. Kyle described his place as a dump with almost no furnishings, lukewarm water, bugs, and uninsulated walls. He claimed to be looking for something much nicer, but then what first-year associate had time to look for an apartment? The truth was that he wanted a dump for that very reason. He could keep guests away, and in doing so avoid the risks of having their conversations listened to and recorded. Though he had not attempted to rid the place of mics and electronic bugs, he knew they were there. He suspected there were cameras, always watching. And since he had lulled them into believing that he was clueless about their surveillance, he went through the motions each day of living pretty much like a hermit. Intruders came and went, at least one per week, but there were no invited guests. Dale was content to meet at her place. She had a fear of bugs. If you only knew, thought Kyle. My apartment has every kind of bug known to the covert world. They eventually managed to sleep together without actually falling asleep beforehand. Both collapsed shortly afterward. They had violated firm policy on at least 4 occasions and had no plans to stop. When Baxter called and asked if he could crash at Kyle's for a few days, Kyle was ready with a string of lies that were mildly convincing. Joey had sent a mayday call from his desk phone to Kyle's just minutes after he'd said goodbye to Baxter. We gotta do something, Joey said over and over until Kyle told him to shut up. The idea of Baxter lounging around his apartment and talking at length about the Elaine episode was almost too much to imagine. Kyle could see Benny with his technicians, clutching his headphones, listening to Baxter preach about the need to confront the past, admit everything, and so on. If the Elaine episode blew up back in Pittsburgh, Kyle would be dragged into it at some level, and Benny would risk losing his leverage in New York. Sorry, Bax, Kyle said happily on his cell phone. I have only one bedroom, if you can call it that, and my cousin has been sleeping on the sofa for a month. She's in New York looking for a job, and, well, I gotta say, the place is cramped. Baxter checked into the Soho Grand. They met for a late pizza at an all-night joint on Bleecker Street in the Village. Kyle picked the place because he'd been there before, and as always, had taken notes on its suitability for future use. One door in and out, large front windows that faced the sidewalk, lots of noise, and it was too small for one of the bloodhounds to enter without being noticed. Kyle arrived at 9:45, 15 minutes early so he could secure a booth and sit facing the door. He pretended to be engrossed in a thick document, the tireless associate ever dedicated to his work. Baxter was wearing the same dungarees, sweater, and combat boots Joey had described. They embraced, then fell into the booth talking nonstop. They ordered soft drinks, and Kyle said, I talked to Joey. Congrats on the rehab. You look great.
Thanks. I've thought about you a lot in the past few months. You quit drinking during our sophomore year, right?
Right.
I can't remember why.
A counselor told me that the drinking would only get worse. I didn't have a serious problem, but one was definitely foreseeable, so I quit. Didn't touch a drop until a few weeks ago, when I had some wine. So far, so good. If I get worried, I'll quit again.
I had 3 bleeding ulcers when they took me in. I thought about suicide, but I didn't really want to do it because I'd missed the vodka and cocaine. I was a mess.
They ordered a pizza and talked for a long time about the past. Primarily Baxter's. He unloaded story after story about the last 3 years in L.A., trying to break into the movie business, the parties, the drug scene, the gorgeous young girls from every small town in America doing everything physically possible to either get a break or marry rich. Kyle listened intently while keeping an eye on the front door and the front windows. Nothing. They talked about their old friends, Kyle's new job, Baxter's new life. After an hour, when the pizza was gone, they eventually got around to more pressing matters.
I guess Joey told you about Elaine, Baxter said.
Of course he did. It's a bad idea, Baxter. I understand the law, and you don't. You're walking into quicksand, and you could take us with you.
But you did nothing. Why are you worried?
Here's a scenario, Kyle said, leaning closer, eager to unveil a narrative he'd thought about for hours. You go see Elaine, looking for some type of redemption, forgiveness, whatever you think you might find there. You apologize to someone you once hurt. Maybe she turns the other cheek and accepts your apology, and you two have a nice hug and say goodbye. That probably will not happen. What is much more likely to happen is that she chooses not to take the Christian approach, doesn't give a rip about this cheek-turning business, and decides, with the advice of a pretty nasty lawyer, that what she really wants is justice. She wants vindication. She cried rape once and nobody listened. You, with the best intentions, will vindicate her with your awkward apology. She feels violated now, and she likes being the victim. Her lawyer starts to push, and things unravel quickly. There's a prosecutor in Pittsburgh who, not surprisingly, likes to see his face on the front page. Like all prosecutors, he's tired of the mundane, the gang shootings, the daily street crime. Suddenly he has a chance to go after four white boys from Duquesne, and one just happens to be a Tate. Not only a great white defendant, but four of them. Talk about headlines, press conferences, interviews. He'll be the hero, and we'll be the criminals. Of course, we are entitled to a trial, but that's a year away, a year of absolutely terrifying hell. You can't do it, Baxter. You'll hurt too many people.
What if I offer her money? A deal with only two parties, me and her.
It might work. I'm sure she and her lawyer would enjoy those discussions. But offering money implies guilt, an admission of some sort. I don't know Elaine, and neither do you. But given Joey's encounter, it's safe to say she is not too stable. We can't predict how she will react. It's too risky.
I can't live with myself until I talk to her, Kyle. I feel like I harmed her in some way.
Got that. It sounds great in the AA handbook, but it's a different matter when other people are involved. You have to forget about this and put it behind you.
I'm not sure I can.
There's an element of selfishness here, Baxter. You want to do something that you think will make you feel better. Well, good for you. What about the rest of us? Your life will be more complete. Our lives could be ruined. You're dead wrong here. Leave this girl alone.
I can apologize to Elaine without admitting I committed a crime. I'll just say that I was wrong and want to apologize.
Her lawyer is not stupid, and her lawyer will be sitting there with a tape recorder, probably a video camera. Kyle took a sip of a diet soda and had a quick flashback to the first video. If Baxter saw it now, saw himself tag-teaming with Joey while Elaine was motionless, his guilt would crush him.
I have to do something!
No, you don't, Kyle said, raising his voice for the first time. He was surprised at the stubbornness across the table.
You don't have the right to ruin our lives. I'm not ruining your life, Kyle. You did nothing wrong. Is she awake?
Joey asks. The words rattle around the courtroom. The jurors scowl at the four defendants. Maybe they feel compassion for Kyle and Alan because there is no evidence that they violated the girl and find them not guilty. Maybe they're sick of the whole bunch and send them all to prison.
I'll take all the blame,
Baxter said.
Why are you so determined to get yourself into more trouble than you can imagine? You're toying with prison here, Baxter. Wake up, man!
I'll take the blame,
he repeated, very much the martyr now.
You guys will walk.
You're not listening to me, Baxter. This is far more complicated than you realize. A shrug.
Maybe so.
Listen to me, damn it!
I'm listening to you, Kyle, but I'm also listening to the Lord.
Well, I can't compete.
And he's leading me to Elaine. to forgiveness. And I believe she will listen, and she will forgive, and she will forget.
He was firm and pious, and Kyle realized he had little else to throw at Baxter.
Let it sit for a month, Kyle said. Don't do anything hasty. Joey, Allen, and I should have a say in the matter.
Let's go. I'm tired of sitting here.
They roamed the village for half an hour before Kyle, exhausted, finally said goodnight. He was dead to the world when his cell phone rang 3 hours later. It was Baxter.
I talked to Elaine, he announced proudly. Tracked her down, called her, woke her up, and we talked for a few minutes.
You idiot!
Kyle blurted before he could stop himself.
It went pretty well, actually.
What did you say?
Kyle was in the bathroom, splashing water on his face with one hand and holding his phone with the other.
Told her I've never felt right about what happened. I didn't admit to anything other than some misgivings.
Thank God for that.
What did she say?
She thanked me for calling. Then she cried and said no one has ever believed her. She still feels like she was raped. She's always known it was Joey and me, with you and Alan somewhere close by watching the action.
That's not true.
We're gonna meet in a couple of days, have lunch, just the two of us in Scranton.
Don't do it, Baxter. Please don't do it. You will regret it forever.
I know what I'm doing, Kyle. I've prayed about this for hours, and I'm trusting God to get me through it. She promised not to tell her lawyer. You gotta have faith.
She works for her lawyer part-time. Did she tell you that, Baxter? No, she did not. You'll walk into a trap and your life will be over.
My life is just beginning, old pal. Faith, Kyle. Faith. Good night.
The phone snapped shut. The connection was dead. Baxter flew back to Pittsburgh the following morning, retrieved his car, a Porsche he planned to sell, from the long-term parking area, and checked into a motel by the airport. Credit card records revealed that he spent 2 nights in the motel and never checked out. His cell phone records showed numerous incoming calls and text messages from both Joey Bernardo and Kyle McAvoy, with no outgoing calls in return. He had 2 long conversations with brother Manny in Reno, and some short ones with his parents and his brother in Pittsburgh. There were 2 calls to Elaine Keenan. On the last day of his life, he left Pittsburgh before sunrise, headed for Scranton, a drive that would cover 300 miles in about 5 hours. According to the credit card trail, he stopped for gas at a Shell station near the intersection of I-79 and I-80, about 90 minutes north of Pittsburgh. He then headed due east on I-80 and traveled 2 hours until his journey came to an end. Near the small town of Snowshoe, he stopped at a rest area and went to the men's room. It was approximately 10:40 a.m. on a Friday in mid-November. Traffic was light, and there were only a few other vehicles at the rest area. Mr. Dwight Navosky, a retiree from Dayton who was traveling to Vermont with his wife, who was already in the ladies' room, discovered Baxter not long after he had been shot. He was still alive, but dying quickly from a gunshot to the head. Mr. Navosky found him on the floor by the urinals, his jeans unzipped, the floor covered with blood and urine. The young man was gasping and whimpering and thrashing about like a deer hit by a car. There was no one else in the men's room when Mr. Navosky walked in and stumbled upon the horrible scene. Evidently, the murderer followed Baxter into the toilet, took a look around to make sure they were alone, then quickly placed a 9mm pistol, a Beretta, according to the lab, at the base of Baxter's skull and fired once. A silencer muffled the gunshot. The rest area was not equipped with surveillance cameras. The Pennsylvania State Police closed the rest stop and sealed the area around it. 6 travelers, including Mr. and Mrs. Navosky, were questioned at length at the crime scene. One gentleman remembered a yellow Penske rental truck coming and going, but he had no idea how long it was there. The group estimated that another 4 or 5 vehicles had left the rest area after the body was discovered, but before the police arrived. No one could recall seeing Baxter enter the men's room, nor did anyone see the murderer follow him in. A lady from Rhode Island recalled noticing a man standing by the door to the men's room when she entered the ladies, and upon further reflection, she agreed that it was possible he might have been a lookout. He was not going in, nor was he coming out. Regardless, he was long gone, and her description was limited to male, white, somewhere between the ages of 30 and 45, at least 5'8", but no more than 6'4", wearing a dark jacket that could have been leather, linen, wool, cotton, anything. Along with the lab reports and autopsy, her description was the extent of the physical evidence. Baxter's wallet, cash fold, and watch were untouched. The police inventoried his pockets and found nothing but a few coins, his car keys, and a tube of lip balm. The lab would later report that there was no trace of alcohol or illegal drugs in his system, on his clothing, or in his car. The pathologist did note a remarkable degree of liver damage for a 25-year-old. Robbery was immediately ruled out for the obvious reasons. Nothing was taken, unless the victim was carrying something valuable that no one knew about. But why would an armed thief leave behind $513 in cash and 8 credit cards? Wouldn't a thief consider stealing the Porsche while he had the chance? There was no evidence that the crime had anything to do with sex. It could have been a drug hit, but that seemed unlikely. Those were usually much messier. With sex, robbery, and drugs ruled out, the investigators began scratching their heads. They watched the bagged body disappear into the rear of an ambulance for the ride back to Pittsburgh, and they knew they had a problem. The apparent randomness of the act, plus the silent gunshot and the clean getaway, led them to conclude, at least at the scene, that they were dealing with professionals. The confirmation that a member of such a noted family had met such a strange and brutal end brightened up a dull news day in Pittsburgh. Television crews scampered to the Tate estate in Shadyside, only to be met by private security personnel. For generations, the Tate family had offered no comment to every inquiry, and this tragedy was no different. A family lawyer issued a terse response and asked for prayers, consideration, and respect for privacy. Uncle Wally once again took charge and issued orders. Kyle was at his cube, chatting with Dale about their plans for the evening when the call came from Joey. It was almost 5 p.m. on Friday. He had eaten a pizza with Baxter late on Tuesday night, then chatted with him a few hours later, but had not spoken to him since. As far as he and Joey could tell, Baxter had disappeared, or at least he was ignoring his phone. "What's the matter?" Dale asked as she noticed the look of shock. But Kyle did not respond. He kept the phone to his ear and began walking away, down the hall, past the front desk, listening as Joey unloaded all the details now being splashed across the television. He lost him in the elevator, and once outside the building, he called Joey back and kept listening. The sidewalks along Broad were packed with the late afternoon rush. Kyle plodded along, without a coat to layer against the chill, without a clue as to where he might be going. "They killed him," he finally said to Joey.
"Who?"
"I think you know."
Chapter 28. "A funeral lasts for 2 hours," Doug Beckham was saying as he glared at Kyle. "I don't understand why you need to take 2 days off."
"The funeral is in Pittsburgh. I have to fly there, then fly back. He was a fraternity brother. I'm a pallbearer. I'll need to see the family."
"Come on, Doug."
"I've done funerals.
For a 25-year-old roommate shot in the head?"
"I get all that. But 2 days?"
"Yes. Call it a vacation. Call it personal time. Don't we get a few personal days a year?"
"Sure. It's somewhere in the handbook, but no one takes them."
"Then I'm taking them. Fire me. I don't give a damn."
A deep breath on both sides of the desk, and Doug said calmly,
"Okay. Okay.
When is the funeral?"
2:00 Wednesday afternoon."
"Then leave late tomorrow afternoon and meet me here at 5:30 Thursday morning.
Gotta tell you, Kyle, this place is a powder keg. This Toby Rowland split is getting nastier and larger, and those of us who stay behind are about to get dumped on."
"He was my roommate.
And I'm sorry."
"Oh, thank you."
Doug waved off the last comment, picked up a thick file, and thrust it across the desk. "Can you read this on the airplane?"
While phrased like a question, it was an outright command.
Kyle took the file and locked his jaws to keep from saying, "Sure, Doug. I'll give it a look on the plane, and I'll sneak a peek at the wake, and I'll analyze the damned thing during the service and review my thoughts at the burial when they lower Baxter into his grave. And then, when I'm flying back to LaGuardia, I'll flip through it again. And for every minute I'm even remotely thinking about this file, I'll bill, or double bill, or maybe even triple bill, the poor client who made the mistake of selecting this full-service sweatshop for its legal needs.
You okay? Doug asked.
No. Look, I'm sorry. I don't know what else to say.
There's nothing to say.
Any clue as to who pulled the trigger?
Doug shifted his weight as he attempted a bit of small talk.
He feigned, badly, interest in what had happened.
No. If you only knew, Kyle thought.
I'm sorry, Doug said again, and his effort at showing interest was gone. Kyle started for the door, but stopped when he heard, I asked you to estimate my hours for the Ontario Bank case, didn't I? Over lunch, remember? I need the hours.
Estimate your own damned hours, Kyle ached to say. Or better yet, just keep up with your time like everybody else.
Almost done, Kyle said, and made it through the door without further abuse. The interment of Baxter Farnsworth Tate took place on a damp and overcast day at the family burial plot in Homewood Cemetery in central Pittsburgh. It followed a staid and by-the-book Episcopal service that was closed to the public and especially closed to the media. Baxter left a brother who attended the service and a sister who did not. Over the weekend, the brother made a gallant effort to restructure the funeral into a celebration of Baxter's life, an idea that fell flat with the ultimate realization that there was so little to celebrate. The brother yielded to the rector, who led them through the standard rituals of remembering someone whom he, the rector, had never met. Ollie Geis, a beta from Cleveland who had lived with Baxter for 2 of their years at Duquesne, struggled through a eulogy that evoked a few smiles. Of the 8 surviving members of their pledge class, 7 were present. There was also a respectable showing from old Pittsburgh, some childhood friends and those required to attend because they came from the upper crust. There were 4 long-forgotten pals from the second-tier boarding school the Tates had shipped Baxter to when he was 14 years old. Unknown to Kyle and the others, Elaine Keenan had attempted to enter the church, but was turned away because her name was not on the list. No one from Hollywood made it to the funeral. Not a single soul from L.A. Baxter's C-list agent sent flowers. A former female roommate emailed the rector a brief eulogy that she insisted be read by someone in attendance. She was on the set and couldn't get away. Her eulogy made references to the Buddha and Tibet and was not well received in Pittsburgh. The rector tossed it without a word to the family. Brother Manny managed to talk his way into the church, but only after Joey Bernardo convinced the family that Baxter had spoken highly of his pastor in Reno. The family, along with all the other mourners, eyed Brother Manny with some suspicion. He wore his standard white uniform, baggy bleached dungarees and flowing shirt tail, and layered it with a garment that was probably a robe of some variety, but looked more like a white bedsheet. His only concession to the solemnity of the occasion was a black leather beret that adorned his tumbling gray locks and gave him an odd resemblance to an aging Che Guevara. He wept throughout the service, shedding more tears than the rest of the hidebound and stoic collection combined. Kyle shed no tears, though he was deeply saddened by such a wasted life. As he stood next to the grave and stared at the oak casket, he was unable to dwell on the good times they had shared. He was too consumed with the raging internal debate over what he should have done differently. In particular, should he have told Baxter about the video, about Benny and the boys, about everything? If he had done so, would Baxter have appreciated the danger and behaved differently? Maybe. Maybe not. In his zeal to clean up his past, Baxter might have gone nuts if he knew he'd actually been filmed doing whatever he did to Elaine. He might have confessed under oath and said to hell with everybody else. It was impossible to predict, because Baxter was not thinking rationally. And it was impossible to second guess now, because Kyle did not foresee the extent of the danger. But he certainly saw it now. There were about 100 mourners huddled around the gravesite, all pressing close together to hear the final words from the rector. A few cold raindrops hurried things along.
A crimson tent provided shelter for the casket and the family seated near it. Kyle glanced away, at the rows of tombstones where the old money was buried, and beyond them to the stone gate at the cemetery's entrance. On the other side of the entrance was a large pack of media types, waiting like vultures for a glimpse of something newsworthy. Ready with cameras, lights, and microphones, they had been kept away from the church by the police and private guards, but they had dogged the procession like kids at a parade, and now they were desperate for a shot of the casket or the mother collapsing as she said goodbye. Somewhere in their midst was at least one of Benny's boys, maybe two or three. Kyle wondered if they had a camera, not for a shot of the casket, but to record which of Baxter's friends had bothered to attend. Useless information, really, but then so much of what they did made no sense. They knew how to kill, though. There was little doubt about that. The state police had nothing to say so far, and as the days passed, it was becoming evident that their silence was not necessarily of their choosing. There was simply no evidence. A clean hit, a silent bullet, a quick getaway, and no motive whatsoever. Brother Manny wailed loudly from the edge of the tent, and this rattled everyone else. The rector missed a beat, then droned on. Kyle stared at the horde in the distance, too far away for any one face to be recognized. He knew they were there, watching, waiting, curious about his movements and those of Joey and Alan Strock, who'd driven in from med school at Ohio State. The four roommates, now reduced to three. As the rector wound down, a few sobs could be heard. Then the crowd began backing away from the crimson tent, inching away from the gravesite. The burial was over, and Baxter's parents and brother wasted no time in leaving. Kyle and Joey held back, and for a moment stood near the tombstone of another Tate. "This will be our last conversation for a long time," Joey said softly but firmly. "You're messing around with the wrong people, Kyle. Just leave me out of it." Kyle looked at the pile of fresh dirt about to be packed on top of Baxter. Joey kept on, his lips barely moving as if bugs were close by. "Count me out, okay? I've got my hands full here. I've got a life with a wedding and a baby in the future. No more of your silly spy games. You keep playing if you want, but not me."
"Sure, Joey."
"No more emails, packages, phone calls. No more trips to New York. I can't keep you out of Pittsburgh, but if you visit here, don't call me. One of us will be next, Kyle, and it won't be you. You're too valuable. You're the one they need. So for our next mistake, guess who gets the bullet?"
"We didn't cause his death."
"Are you sure about that?"
"No."
"These guys are around for a reason, and that reason is you."
"Thanks, Joey."
"Don't mention it. I'm going now. Please keep me out of it, Kyle. And be damned sure nobody sees that video. So long."
Kyle allowed him to walk ahead, then he followed.
Chapter 29. At 6:30 on Thursday morning, Kyle walked into Doug Packham's office and reported for duty. Doug was standing at his desk, which resembled, as always, a landfill. "How's the funeral?" he asked without looking up from whatever he was holding.
"It was a funeral," Kyle said.
He handed over a single sheet of paper.
"Here is an estimate of your hours on the Ontario bank case."
Doug snatched it, scanned it, disapproved of it, and said,
"Only 30 hours?
"At the most."
"You're way off. Double it, and let's call it 60.
Kyle shrugged. "Call it whatever you want. You're the partner. If the client could pay $24,000 for work that wasn't performed, then the client could certainly pay another $24,000 on top of that."
"We have a hearing in federal court at 9. We'll leave here at 8:30. Finish the Rule 10 memo and be here at 8.
The prospect of a litigation associate getting near a courtroom during his or her first year was unheard of, and for Kyle, a gloomy day suddenly improved. Of the 12 in his class, no one, at least to his knowledge, had seen live action. He hurried to his cube and was checking emails when Tabor appeared with a tall coffee and a haggard look. Since flunking the bar, he had slowly managed to put himself back together, and though he was initially humbled, the cockiness was returning.
"Sorry about your friend," he said,
flinging his overcoat and briefcase. Thanks, Kyle said. Tabor was still standing, slurping coffee and anxious to talk. Have you met H.W. Pruitt, litigation partner two floors up? He asked. No, Kyle answered, still pecking away. He's about 50, big Texan. They call him Harvey Wayne behind his back. Get it? Harvey Wayne, from Texas, double first name. Got it. They also call him Texas Slim because he weighs about 400 pounds. Mean as hell. Went to a community college, then A&M, then Texas Law, and hates anybody from Harvard. He's been stalking me. Caught me 2 days ago and gave me a project that any part-time secretary could handle. I spent 6 hours Tuesday night taking apart exhibit binders for a big deposition yesterday. Took them apart, then reconfigured them just the way Harvey Wayne wanted. There were a dozen binders, a couple of hundred pages each, a ton of paperwork. At 9 yesterday morning, I put them on a cart, raced them down to a conference room where about 100 lawyers are gathered for this depo, and what did Harvey Wayne do? What? There's this door that leads to another conference room, and it won't stay shut, sort of swings back and forth. And so Harvey Wayne, fat ass, tells me to stack the binders on the floor and use them as a doorstop. I do what he tells me, and as I'm leaving the room, I hear him say something like, "Those Harvard boys make the best paralegals." How much coffee have you had?
Second cup.
I'm on my first, and I really need to crank out this memo.
Sorry. Look, have you seen Dale?
No, I left Tuesday afternoon for the funeral yesterday. Something the matter?
She got nailed with some heinous project Tuesday night, and I don't think she slept at all. Let's keep an eye on her.
Will do. At 8:30, Kyle left the office with Doug Peckham and a senior associate named Noel Bard. They walked hurriedly to a parking garage a few blocks away, and when the attendant pulled up in Bard's late model Jaguar, Peckham said, "Kyle, you drive. We're going to Foley Square." Kyle wanted to protest, but said nothing. Bard and Peckham climbed into the rear seat, leaving Kyle, the chauffeur, alone in the front. "I'm not sure of the best route," Kyle admitted, with a flash of fear at what would happen if he got lost and the two big shots in the back were late for court.
"Stay on Broad until it becomes Nassau. Take it all the way to Foley Square," Bard said, as if he made the drive every day. "And be careful. This little baby is brand new and cost me $100,000. It's my wife's."
Kyle could not remember being so nervous behind the wheel. He finally found the mirror adjustment scheme and eased into traffic, cutting his eyes in all directions. To make matters worse, Peckham wanted to talk.
"Kyle, a couple of names, all first years. Darren Bartofsky?"
Without glancing at Peckham in the rearview mirror, Kyle waited and finally said,
"So? You know him?"
"Sure, I know all of the first-year litigation associates."
"What about him? Have you worked with him? Good, bad? Talk to me, Kyle. How would you evaluate him?"
Well, nice guy. I knew him at Yale."
"His work, Kyle, his work."
"I haven't worked with him yet."
"The word is he's a slacker. Ducks the partners, late with projects, lazy with the billing."
I wonder if he estimates his hours, Kyle thought, but kept his concentration on the yellow cabs passing, darting, turning abruptly, violating every known rule of the road.
"Have you heard he's a slacker, Kyle?"
"Yes," Kyle said reluctantly. It was the truth. Bard decided to help thrash poor Bartofsky.
"He's billed the fewest hours so far of anyone in your class."
Talking about colleagues was a contact sport at the firm, and the partners were as bad as the associates. An associate who cut corners or ducked projects was labeled a slacker, and the tag was permanent. Most slackers didn't mind. They worked less, got the same salary, and ran almost no risk of being fired unless they stole money from a client or got caught in a sex scandal. Their bonuses were small, but who needs a bonus when you have a fat paycheck? Career slackers could slide for 6 or 7 years at a firm before being informed that they would not make partner and shown the door.
"What about Jeff Tabor?" Doug asked.
"I know him well. Definitely not a slacker."
"He has the reputation of being a gunner," Doug said.
"Yes, and that's accurate. He's competitive, but he's not a cutthroat."
"You like him, Kyle?"
"Yes. Tabor's a good guy. Smart as hell."
"Evidently not smart enough," Bard said. "That bar exam problem."
Kyle had no comment,
and no comment was necessary because a yellow cab swerved in front of them, cutting off the Jaguar and forcing Kyle to slam on the brakes and hit the horn at the same time. A fist shot out from the driver's window, then an angry middle finger, and Kyle received his first bird. "Be cool," he said to himself.
"You gotta watch these idiots," Doug said.
The sound of important papers being extracted crackled from the back seat, and Kyle knew something was being reviewed.
"Will we get Judge Hennessy or his magistrate?" Doug asked Bard.
Kyle was shut out of the conversation, which was fine with him. He preferred to concentrate on the street in front of him, and he had no interest in assessing the performance of his colleagues. After 10 minutes of downtown traffic, Kyle was wet under the collar and breathing heavy.
"There's a lot at the corner of Nassau and Chambers, 2 blocks from the courthouse," Bard announced.
Kyle nodded nervously. He found the lot, but it was full, and this caused all manner of cursing in the rear seat.
Peckham took charge. "Look, Kyle, we're in a hurry. Just drop us off in front of the courthouse at Foley Square, then circle the block until you find a spot on the street."
"A spot on which street?"
Doug was stuffing papers back into his briefcase. Bard suddenly had business on the phone. "I don't care. Any street. And if you can't find a spot, then just keep making the block. Let us out here."
Kyle cut to the curb, and a horn erupted somewhere behind them. Both lawyers scrambled out of the rear seat. Peckham's final words were,
"Just keep moving, okay? You'll find something."
Bard managed to tear himself away from his phone conversation long enough to say,
"And be careful. It's my wife's."
Alone, Kyle eased away and tried to relax. He headed north on Center Street, drove 4 blocks, then turned left on Leonard and headed west. Every inch of available space was packed with vehicles and motorbikes. An amazing abundance of signs warned against parking anywhere near a potential space. Kyle had never noticed so many threatening signs. He passed no parking garages, but he did pass several traffic cops working the streets, slapping tickets on windshields. After a long, slow block, he turned left on Broadway, and the traffic was even heavier. He inched along for 6 blocks, then turned left onto Chambers. 2 blocks later, he was back at the courthouse, in which he was supposed to be making his debut as a litigator, if only as a reserve. Left on Center, left on Leonard, left on Broadway, left on Chambers, back at the courthouse. Ever concerned about billing, he noted the time. The second loop ate 17 minutes of the clock, and along the way, Kyle again saw nowhere to park. He saw the same signs, same traffic cops, same street bums, same drug dealer sitting on a bench working his cell phone. 9 o'clock came and went without a call from Peckham, not even a quick, "Where the hell are you?" The hearing was underway, but without Kyle the litigator. Kyle the chauffeur, though, was hard at work. After 3 loops, he was bored with the route and added extra blocks to the north and west. He thought about stopping for a coffee to go, but decided against it out of fear of spilling something onto the fine beige leather of Bard's wife's new Jaguar. He had settled into the leather and was comfortable behind the wheel. It was a very nice car. $100,000, and no doubt worth every penny. The gas tank was half full, and this was worrying him. The stop-and-go driving was a strain on such a large engine. The hearing that he was missing was an important one, no doubt requiring the presence of many high-powered lawyers, all anxious to plead their positions, and things might drag on for a long time. It was obvious that every legal parking spot in Lower Manhattan was taken, and with clear instructions to just keep moving, Kyle accepted the fact that he had no choice but to burn fuel. He began to look for a gas station. He'd fill the tank, bill the client, and score a few points with Bard. Once the tank was full, he began to ponder other ways to score points. A quick car wash? A quick lube job? When he passed the courthouse for the 7th or 8th time, a street vendor selling soft pretzels looked at him, spread his arms, and said something like, "Are you crazy, man?" But Kyle was unperturbed. He decided against a wash or oil change. Now confident in traffic, he picked up his phone and called Dale. She answered on the 3rd ring and in a hushed voice said,
"I'm in the library."
"Are you okay?"
"Yes."
"That's not what I hear." A pause.
"I haven't slept in 2 nights. I think I'm delirious."
"You sound terrible."
"Where are you?"
Right now I'm on Leonard Street, driving Noel Bard's wife's new Jaguar. What do you think I'm doing?
Sorry I asked. How was the funeral?
Terrible. Let's do dinner tonight. I need to unload on someone.
I'm going home tonight, to bed, to sleep.
You have to eat. I'll grab some Chinese. We'll have a glass of wine, then sleep together. No sex whatsoever. We've done it before.
We'll see. I gotta get out of here. Later.
Are you gonna make it?
I doubt it.
At 11 a.m., Kyle congratulated himself because he could now bill the client $800 for driving in circles. Then he laughed at himself. Editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal behind the wheel here, making perfect turns, clean stops and goes, taking in the sights, dodging the cabs. Ah, the life of a big-time Wall Street lawyer. If his father could see him now. The call came at 11:40.
Bard said, "We're leaving the courtroom. What happened to you?"
"I couldn't find a parking space."
"Where are you?"
"Two blocks from the courthouse."
"Pick us up where you dropped us off."
"My pleasure."
Minutes later, Kyle wheeled to the curb like a veteran driver, and his two passengers jumped into the rear seat. He pulled away and said, "Where to?"
"The office," came the terse reply from Peckham,
and for several minutes nothing was said. Kyle expected to be grilled about what he'd been doing for the past few hours.
"Where were you, Kyle? Why did you miss the hearing, Kyle?"
But nothing. Sadly, he began to realize that he had not been missed at all. To create some noise, he finally asked, "So how'd the hearing go?"
"It didn't," said Peckham.
"What hearing?" said Bard.
"What have you been doing since 9 a.m.?" Kyle asked.
"Waiting for the Honorable Theodore Hennessy to shake off his hangover and grace us with his presence," Bard said.
"It was postponed for 2 weeks," Peckham said. As they stepped off the elevator on the 32nd floor, Kyle's phone vibrated. A text message from Tabor read, "Hurry to Cube. Problem." Tabor met him at the stairs.
"So, how was court?"
"Great. I love litigation. What's the problem?" They were walking quickly through the hall, past Sandra, their secretary.
"It's Dale," Tabor whispered. "She fainted, collapsed, passed out, something.
Where is she?"
"I've hidden the body."
At the Cube, Dale was lying peacefully on a sleeping bag partially hidden under Tabor's desk. Her eyes were open. She seemed alert, but her face was very pale.
"She woke up at 5 Tuesday morning and she hasn't slept since. That's about 55 hours, which might be a record."
Kyle knelt beside her, gently took her wrist, and said,
"You okay?"
She nodded yes, but was not convincing. Tabor, the lookout, glanced around and kept talking.
"She doesn't want anyone to know, okay? I say we call the nurse. She says no. What do you say, Kyle?"
"Don't tell anyone,"
Dale said, her voice low and raspy.
"I fainted, that's all. I'm fine."
"Your pulse is good," Kyle said. "Can you walk?"
"I think so."
"Then the three of us will slip out for a quick lunch," Kyle said. "I'll take you home and you're going to rest. Tabor, call a car." With a hand under each arm, they slowly pulled her up. She stood, took deep breaths, and said,
"I can walk."
"We're right beside you," Kyle said.
They caught a curious glance or two as they left the building. One petite, well-dressed young associate, with very pale skin, arm in arm with two of her colleagues, off for a quick lunch, no doubt, but no one cared. Tabor helped her into the car, then returned to the Cube to cover their trails, if necessary. Kyle half carried her up the three flights to her apartment, then helped her undress and tucked her in. He kissed her forehead, turned off the lights, and closed the door. She did not move for hours. In the den, he took off his coat, tie, and shoes. He covered the small kitchen table with his laptop, firm phone, and a file full of research for a memo he'd been neglecting. Once he was fully situated, his eyelids became heavier and heavier until he walked to the sofa for a quick nap. Tabor called an hour later and woke him up. Kyle assured him Dale was sleeping well and would be fine after a long rest.
"There's an announcement coming at 4 p.m., Tabor said. "Big news about the split. Watch your emails."
At exactly 4 p.m., Scully and Pershing sent an email to all of its lawyers announcing the departure of 6 partners and 31 associates from its litigation practice group. The names were listed. The departures were effective as of 5 p.m. that day. The bulletin then proceeded with the standard drivel touting the greatness of the firm and assuring everyone that the split would have no impact on the firm's ability to fully service the needs of its many wonderful and valuable clients. Kyle peeked through the bedroom door. The patient was breathing nicely and had not changed positions. He dimmed the lights in the den and stretched out on the sofa. Forget the memo. Forget the billing. To hell with the firm, at least for a few stolen moments. How often would he have the chance to relax like this on a Thursday afternoon? The funeral seemed like a month ago. Pittsburgh was in another galaxy. Baxter was gone, but not forgotten. He needed Joey, but Joey was gone too. The vibration of the phone woke him again. The email was from Doug Peckham, and it read, "Kyle, major realignment in litigation. I've been added to the Trilon case. So have you. Office of Wilson Rush, 7 a.m. sharp tomorrow." Chapter 30. For the senior litigation partner and member of the firm's management committee, the cost of square footage was not a concern. Wilson Rush's office was spread over a large corner on the 31st floor, an area at least 4 times larger than any Kyle had yet seen. Mr. Rush evidently liked boats. His polished and gleaming oak desk was mounted on 4 rudders from old sailing yachts. A long credenza behind it held a collection of intricate models of sleek clippers and schooners. Every painting depicted a grand vessel at sea. As Kyle walked in and did a quick scan, he caught himself almost waiting for the floor to rock and the salt water to splash across his feet. But he forgot about the decor when Mr. Rush said, "Good morning, Kyle. Over here." The great man was rising from a large conference table at the far end of his office. A crowd had already gathered there, and heavy lifting was underway. Kyle sat next to Doug Peckham. Quick introductions were made. There were 9 others present, excluding Mr. Rush and Mr. Peckham, and Kyle recognized most of the faces, including that of Sherry Abney, the senior associate Benny had been shadowing. She smiled. Kyle smiled back. Mr. Rush, seated at the head of the table, launched into a quick review of the current upheaval. 2 of the partners who'd mutinied with Toby Rowland and 7 of the 31 associates had been assigned to the Trilon versus Barton case. Much more about that in a minute. And it was imperative that the firm's manpower be shuffled immediately because the client, Trilon, was important and demanding. Therefore, 2 partners, Doug Peckham and a woman named Isabel Gaffney, were entering the fray, along with 8 associates. Mr. Rush was explaining how uneasy the in-house boys at Trilon were with the defections, and how necessary it was to shore up the troops, to literally throw more lawyers at Ape and Barton Dynamics. Isabel, or Izzy behind her back, was somewhat notorious because she had once required 2 associates to wait in the delivery room while she was temporarily sidetracked giving birth to a child. Firm lore held that no one had ever seen her smile, and she wasn't about to smile as Mr. Rush went on about the reshuffling and realigning and deft maneuvering of the unlimited legal talent at his disposal. 2 first-year associates were being added, Kyle and a mysterious young man from Penn named Atwater. Of the 12 litigation rookies, Atwater was by far the quietest and loneliest. Dale was a distant second, but she had warmed up nicely, at least in Kyle's opinion. He'd spent the night on her sofa again, alone, while she was dead to the world. He'd slept little. There was too much to consider. The shock of being assigned to the Trilon case caused him to stare at the ceiling and mumble to himself. The horror of Baxter's murder, the images of the funeral and burial, the harsh words of Joey Bernardo. Who could sleep with such nightmares rattling around? Late that night, Kyle had called Peckham and picked and probed to find out why he had been selected to a case he had been rather vocal in trying to avoid. Peckham had no sympathy and was not in the mood to talk. The decision had been made by Wilson Rush. End of conversation. Mr. Rush was now going through the basics of the lawsuit, material Kyle had committed to memory weeks and months earlier. Binders were passed around. A half hour dragged by, and Kyle began to wonder how a person as dull and methodical as Wilson Rush could be so successful in the courtroom. Discovery was underway, with both parties at war over the documents. At least 20 depositions had been scheduled. Kyle took notes because everyone else was taking notes, but he was thinking about Benny. Did Benny already know that Kyle had landed the prize position? Benny had known every member of the Trilon team. He knew that Sherry Abney supervised Jack McDougal. Was there another spy in the firm? Another victim of Benny and his blackmail? If so, was this person watching Kyle and reporting to Benny? Though he hated every meeting with Benny, their next encounter would be the biggest challenge. Kyle would go through the motions and engage in somewhat civilized conversation with the man responsible for the murder of Baxter Tate, and he would be forced to do so without a hint that he was remotely suspicious.
"Any questions?" Mr. Rush asked.
"Sure," Kyle thought. "More questions than you can possibly answer." After a full hour of update and review, Kyle, Atwater, and the other six new associates were led by Sherry Abney to the secret room on the 18th floor. Secret to some, but Benny and Nigel certainly knew about it. Along the way, they were introduced to a non-lawyer named Gant, a security expert of some variety. Gant stopped them at the door and explained that it was the only door. One way in and one way out, and a coated plastic strip smaller than a credit card was required for entry and exit. Each lawyer was given a card, and every time the lawyer came or went, it was recorded. Gant nodded at the ceiling and informed them that there were video cameras watching everything. Inside, the room was about the size of Wilson Rush's office. No windows, bare walls, drab olive carpet. There was nothing in the room but 10 square tables with a large computer on each one. Sherry Abney took charge. "This case now has over 4 million documents, and they're all right here in our virtual warehouse," she said, patting a computer like a proud mother. "The actual paperwork is in secured storage in a facility in Wilmington, but you can access it all from one of these. The main server is locked up in a room next door." She kept patting. "These are pretty fancy computers, custom-made by a company you've never heard of and never will. Do not, under any circumstances, attempt to repair, examine, or just plain fiddle with the hardware. The software is called Sonic, and it too is customized for this case. It's really just some home brew that our computer folks put together, a variation of Barrister with some bells and whistles added for security reasons. Passcode changes every week. Password changes every day, sometimes twice a day. When it changes, you will receive a coded email. If you try to access with the wrong code or password, then all manner of hell breaks loose. You could be fired." She looked around with as much menace as possible, then continued, "This system is self-contained and cannot be accessed anywhere else within the firm or outside the firm. It's online. You just can't get to it. This is the only place, the only room in which you are able to access the documents, and this room is closed from 10 p.m. until 6 a.m. Sorry, no all-nighters in here, but it is open 7 days a week." At her direction, each associate sat down before a computer and was given a passcode and password. There was nothing on the screen to indicate who manufactured the computer or who wrote the software. Sherry walked from lawyer to lawyer, looking at the monitors and chatting like a college professor. "There's an extensive tutorial at the beginning, and I strongly suggest you go through it today. Pull up the index. The documents are classified in 3 basic groups, with 100 subgroups. Category A contains all the harmless junk that Barton has already been given. Letters, emails, office memos, the list is endless. Category B has important materials that are discoverable, though we have not handed all of them over. Category R, for restricted, is where you'll find the good stuff. About 1 million documents dealing with the technological research that is the heart of this little dispute. It's top secret, classified, and no one but the judge knows if it will ever be shown to Barton. Mr. Rush thinks not. Category R is privileged, confidential, attorney's work product. When you enter Category R, a record of your entry automatically registers with Mr. Gant's computer right next door. Any questions?" All 8 associates stared at their monitors, all thinking the same thing. There are 4 million documents in there, and someone has to examine them.
Sonic is amazing, Sherry said. Once you master it, you will be able to find a document or group of documents within seconds. I'll be here for the rest of the day for a workshop. The sooner you learn your way around our virtual library, the easier your life will be.
At 4:20 on Friday afternoon, Kyle received an email from Benny. It read, "Let's meet tonight at 9 o'clock. Details to follow. BW. Kyle responded, "I can't." Benny responded, "Tomorrow afternoon, say 5 or 6? Kyle, "I can't." Benny, "Sunday night, 10 p.m.? Kyle, "I can't."
Kyle was sleeping when someone rapped on the door of his apartment at 7:10 on Saturday morning.
"Who is it?" he yelled as he stumbled through his cluttered den.
"Benny," came the reply.
"What do you want?" Kyle demanded at the door.
"I brought you some coffee."
Kyle unlocked and unchained the door, and Benny walked by him quickly. He was holding 2 tall paper cups of coffee. He placed them on the counter and looked around.
"What a dump," he said.
"I thought you were making some money."
"What do you want?" Kyle snapped.
"I don't like being ignored," Benny snapped back as he jerked around, ready to pounce. His face was taut and his eyes were hot. He pointed a finger that came within inches of Kyle's face.
"You do not ignore me! Understand?" he hissed.
It was the first real display of temper Kyle had seen from him.
"Be cool."
Kyle brushed by him, their shoulders touching solidly, and walked to the bedroom where he found a t-shirt. When he returned to the den, Benny was removing the tops from the cups.
"I want an update."
The nearest weapon was a cheap ceramic table lamp Kyle had found at a secondhand store. He took the coffee without saying thanks. He glanced at the lamp and thought how nicely it would crack over Benny's bald head, how wonderful it would be to hear them break into pieces, both lamp and skull, and how easily he could pound away until the little bastard was dead but still bleeding on the cheap rug. "Greetings from my old pal Baxter." Kyle took a sip, then took a breath. Both men were still standing. Benny was wearing his gray trench coat. Kyle was decked out in red boxers and a wrinkled t-shirt.
"I got assigned to the Trilon case yesterday.
Big news, huh? Or did you already know this?" Benny's eyes revealed nothing. He took a sip, then said,
"And the secret room on the 18th floor. Tell me about it."
Kyle described it.
"What about the computers?"
"Manufacturer unknown. Basic desktop models, but supposedly custom-built for the project. All linked to a server locked away next door. Lots of memory, all the bells and whistles, video cameras everywhere, and a security expert next door monitoring everything. It's a dead end, if you ask me. There's no way to steal anything."
To which Benny offered a grunt and a smart-ass smirk. "We've cracked much bigger vaults, I assure you of that. Everything can be stolen. Let us worry about that.
Sonic is the software?"
"Yes."
"Have you mastered it?"
"Not yet. I'll go in later this morning for another lesson."
"How many documents?"
"Over 4 million.
That brought the only smile of the morning.
"What about access to the room?"
"Open 7 days a week, but closed from 10 at night until 6 in the morning. There's only one door, and there are at least 3 cameras watching it."
"Does someone check you in?"
"I don't think so, but the key leaves a record of each entry and exit."
"Let me see the key."
Kyle reluctantly got the key from his room and handed it over. Benny examined it like a surgeon, then gave it back.
"I want you to visit the room as often as possible over the next few days. But don't arouse any suspicions. Go at different hours. Watch everything. We'll meet at 10 on Tuesday night, room 1780, Four Seasons Hotel on 57th. Got it?"
"Sure."
"No surprises."
"Yes, sir."
Chapter 31. With 78,000 lawyers in Manhattan, the selection of one should not have been so difficult. Kyle narrowed his list, did more research, added names, and deleted names.
He had begun the secret project not long after he arrived in the city, and had abandoned it several times. He was never sure he would actually hire a lawyer, but wanted the name of a good one just in case. Baxter's murder changed everything. Kyle not only wanted protection, now he wanted justice. Roy Benedict was a criminal defense lawyer with a 200-man firm located in a tall building one block east of Scully and Pershing. The location of the chosen lawyer was crucial, given the attention paid to Kyle's movements. Benedict measured up in other important areas as well. He had worked for the FBI before law school at NYU, and after graduation spent 6 years with the Department of Justice. He had contacts, old friends, people on the other side of the street now, but people he could trust. Crime was his specialty. He was ranked in the top 100 of the city's white-collar defense specialists, but not in the top 10. Kyle needed solid advice, but he couldn't afford an ego. Benedict's firm was often listed as opposing counsel in lawsuits involving Scully and Pershing. The icing on the cake was his basketball career at Duquesne some 25 years earlier. On the phone, he seemed to have little time for small talk and said he wasn't taking any new cases, but the basketball angle opened the door. The appointment was at 2 p.m. on Monday, and Kyle arrived early. He found it impossible to walk through the law firm without comparing it with his. It was smaller, and it spent less trying to impress visitors with abstract art and designer furniture. The receptionists were not as cute. In his briefcase, he had a file on Roy Benedict. Old stats and photos from Duquesne, bios from legal directories, newspaper stories about two of his more notorious cases. He was 47, 6'6", and appeared to be in great shape, ready for a pickup game. His office was busy, smaller than most of the partners at Scully, but nicely appointed. Benedict was cordial and genuinely pleased to meet another New York lawyer who'd played for the Dukes. Kyle explained that he didn't play much. The basketball talk dragged on, and Kyle cut things off by saying, "Look, Mr. Benedict, it's Roy." "Okay, Roy, I can't spend too much time here because I'm being followed." A few seconds passed as Roy allowed this to sink in. "And why is a first-year associate at the biggest law firm in the world being followed?"
"I have a few problems. It's complicated, and I think I need a lawyer."
"I do nothing but white-collar crime, Kyle. Have you screwed up in that area?"
"Not yet, but I'm being pressured to commit a whole list of crimes."
Roy bounced a pencil on his desk, tried to think of how to proceed. "I really need a lawyer," Kyle said. "My initial retainer is 50 grand, Roy said, and watched carefully for a response. He knew within $10,000 how much Kyle was earning as a first-year associate. His firm didn't try to compete with Scully and Pershing, but it came close.
"I can't pay that much. I have $5,000 in cash."
Kyle yanked an envelope from his pocket and tossed it on the desk.
"Give me some time, and I'll get the rest."
"What does this case involve?"
"Rape, murder, theft, wiretapping, extortion, blackmail, and a few others. I can't give you the details until we reach an agreement."
Roy nodded, then smiled. "Is someone following you now?"
"Oh, yes. I've been under surveillance since early February, back at Yale."
"Is your life in danger?"
Kyle thought for a moment. "Yes, I believe so."